This episode of the Western Outdoor News Podcast is brought to you by Western Outdoor News Charters. Friday, September 17th, the Sea Adventure is departing on a 2.5-day trip. And on Sunday, October 3rd, the Pacific Islander departs on a 3.5-day. After that, we have the Ranger 85 on a 2-day trip Sunday, November 7th. For more information on Western Outdoor News Charters, visit wonews.com.
It's an incredible opportunity that Fish and Game gives the hunting community to be able to have a chance to go have access to private property and get a tag that's a once-in-a-lifetime. I mean, this is a once-in-a-lifetime tag, really.
Hey, folks, and welcome back to the Western Outdoor News Podcast. First up this week, we have one editor, Mike Stevens, in studio to talk about the recent closure of all but one national forest in California.
Not because of the risk of existing fires reaching there, but because so many resources are being directed toward the fire around South Lake Tahoe.
These closures really affect the local businesses and anglers of the Eastern Sierra. Mike explains that there are still areas to fish, but how he'd think twice about making the trip as of now. We then sit and talk with hunter John Carrion. We talk about his recent bull elk tag he drew in the DFW Shared Hunt Program. John capitalized big time in mid-August by scoring a huge Thule bull elk, landing him on the cover of Western Outdoor News.
So the bull comes up to the other bull, puts his head down, and starts raking the dirt and throwing dirt. He's 10 feet from this bull, throwing dirt on this other big bull.
This is a story you're not going to want to miss, folks. And without further ado, here's Mike with the recent forest closures in California.
Effectively, every national park or national forest in California has been shut down until September 17th because of fire danger. Not so much from fire spreading to the, well, we'll just use the Eastern Sierra as an example because that's where a lot of our readers spend a lot of time. But not because of the risk of existing fires reaching there, but because so many resources are being directed toward the fire around South Lake Tahoe, that if another major fire broke out anywhere else, it would just be a nightmare. So, yeah, right after we put the paper out on Monday, we saw the press release come across that all the forests are being shut down. Not long after that, we saw announcements from a lot of the resorts, the marinas in the Eastern Sierra saying, yes, this affects us. Campers that were already in campgrounds were given until the next day, which was Tuesday, the next day at noon to be out of the campgrounds. And anybody who had a reservation to camp in anything that was closed, they got emails saying that it was canceled and they got refunds for that. So it's a pretty big mess up there for people who go to the Eastern Sierra or any of our national forests, really.
Yeah, a lot of hunting. Hunters are going to be affected by this with deer season underway. And I guess for the anglers up there, does this mean that, you know, we're not able to fish? But is there still some areas we're allowed to go to? How does this all work?
Yeah, there are some areas you can still go to. It's again, it's just the National Forest property. So anything that falls under LADWP or in the forest that they didn't close, I'm spacing on the name of it right now, the Toyabe up there, that also includes parts of Nevada. Basically, from north of Leviathan through Bridgeport, that's still open.
As far as lower areas away from the mountain.
Yeah, and for the LADWP waters, that includes like Crowley Lake, the Upper Owens River, actually both Upper and Lower Owens are open. Grant Lake, you can still fish. Just going down the list here so I don't leave anything out. Virginia Lakes, Virginia Creek, Green Creek, the lakes in Bridgeport, the Walker Rivers around Bridgeport, Robinson Creek, and all the way to Topaz Lake you can still go to. But all the the Mammoth Lakes Basin, the June Lake Loop, Rock Creek area, Bishop Creek Canyon, that stuff's all under the closure. So
a lot of the good camping stuff
right,
is closed.
Right.
So if you were to say, you know, you want to try to get up there, how do we do it? What's the way to go for a few days?
I could stay in hotels in town, Bishop or Mammoth, condos. Boondock-style camping is also included here. So for that to happen, you'd probably have to do it further down the road, Bishop and Point South, if you wanted to do it that way. But I mean, I wouldn't necessarily recommend going up there right now. I mean, it
seems like the air quality is probably not too great to be around.
Yeah, there's that. Depending on the wind, you can get a lot of the smoke from the big fire. But also, I mean, I couldn't imagine driving up there and only to hear on the radio that more closures. Like maybe the Department of Water Power land becomes part of it. So, I mean, I'm going in October, and I hope things are cleared up by then. But, you know, if I was thinking about going this week or next week and to try to, you know, just fish those waters that are still open, I might reconsider because of
be worth the travel time.
Yeah. You never know if more of this gets closed or if it's closer to the opening date, September 17th, you know, that could always be extended too. So it's a bummer for like the businesses and stuff up there because this is a big weekend for them. I mean, some have told me directly that Labor Day weekend is the biggest weekend of summer for them.
It's kind of the last hurrah for most of these larger resorts.
And especially after last year, you know, when they didn't have an opener. That's the first hurrah. You know, they get a huge influx of business for that opener, and that sustains them in the kind of dead period between the opener and, like, June. And then again, you know, then they get a little boost at 4th of July and then Labor Day. So, I mean, it's a bummer. And
it's really limiting all travel through that whole area.
Yeah. And that's another thing, you know, other fires could pop up. I mean, I once was heading up north on 395, and we got to about Olancha, and we heard on a radio that a fire was approaching 395, and we literally were racing to get past the area where the fire was going to jump the highway, and we beat it by like 15 minutes.
Wow.
And who knows? We might not have had a trip.
Yeah.
You know, if we wouldn't have got through. And, you know, that's just another reason. It's just a tough time to get up there, you know, whether or not there's an active fire going on.
Yeah, because it always is quite the investment just preparing and getting ready for even a quick trip. To get up there and to have to turn around would be horrible.
Yeah, I mean, there are kind of options, you know. You stay down in the valley and fish the Owens if your plan doesn't, you know, pan out. But like I said, it's just a sketchy time to attempt to go up there.
Yeah, I can only imagine that whole lower valley, the Owens and Crowley are going to be pretty crowded for the next week or so.
Yeah, I heard Tuesday was quite the mass exodus up there. So I don't know how many people stayed behind to finish off their trips or how many people are still going up, but anybody who is going up there, especially to fish, they're all going to be to the same like limited, you know,
zones,
waters, and that's not why we go up there.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thanks for the update, Mike, and yeah. I'm sure we'll be hearing back from you soon, and looking forward to hearing back from that October trip you have planned.
Oh yeah, it's we'll keep tabs on this situation, and you know, hopefully the rest of the fall, better for everybody.
Yeah. Awesome, thank you.
Yep.
All right, folks, and let's just roll right into it with John in that cover shot.
Well, my father is an avid fisherman and bird hunter, so I grew up, you know, I was born in 1970, I'm 51, so I can recollect as just a young kid, you know, my dad, I can always remember, you know, deer hunters, you know, the out-of-state thing always is really big in Southern California, and you see guys getting ready to go out-of-state to go deer hunting around October, and I can remember my dad, as a young kid, like 5 years old, he worked for Southern California Edison. There's this big group of guys that were really tight-knit group that hunted together and fished together. So I can remember them coming to the house and packing the trailer to go out in the desert, you know, to go hunt for quail and chukar and openers. And it is funny, but the things I recollect is them coming back and getting to raid all the candy bars left in the trailer. So my dad's always been an avid, you know, outdoorsman, hunt and fish. And they used to go surf fishing every Wednesday night in the spring. They'd go get a scoop of live bait. There'd be 15, 20 guys, and they'd put, you know, a buck a piece in a pot, and whoever caught the biggest surf perch or fish would, you know, win the pot. And so that all got distilled in me at a very early age, and I got addicted to fishing more so. Still really into fishing, but so I just I bird hunted with my dad when I was old enough to get a hunting license. I was hunting quail, and I still remember the first quail I ever shot. But when I was in high school, I really wanted to deer hunt, and my dad's close friend is like a dad to me. I've got two of my dad's friends, both named Kurt, that were like, both of them didn't have sons, and they're both like fathers to me. He loaned me a gun to go deer hunting as a senior in high school. On my second day deer hunting by myself, I shot a little tiny forked horn. I didn't know what to do. It's a true story. I had a fanny pack and a Rapala fillet knife and a piece of rope. And I drug that thing 2 miles. I got home and I called him, and he came down. He gave me a folding pocket knife, showed me how to skin it. I had gutted it, showed me how to skin it. And I'll never forget, he told me, I'd said, hey, I said, tomorrow I'll clean the gun up and I'll give the gun back. And he said, keep the gun. It was an 8mm Mauser with a fixed 4-power scope. He said, keep the gun. He goes, you're going to be addicted to deer hunting. And I didn't miss a day of A zone from the time I was 18 until I was probably in my late 30s when I started having, you know, started having more kids. And it was kind of, I couldn't do it like I did when I was younger. But that same person took me to Colorado in 1989 on my first out-of-state hunting trip. So my dad's friends and the people around him just is what really gave me the great experiences of the outdoors of hunting and fishing and turned me into what my passions are.
And so fast forward now, you're obviously an avid hunter and fisherman still, and you're doing it as often as possible. You pulled a California bull elk tag through a little bit different program, the DFW Shared Hunt Program. Explain how that works.
Yeah, so a little backstory real quick on that. I drew a desert bighorn sheep in 1994. I had started applying when I was, 20 for the special draws. And then I drew that bighorn sheep tag. And so, obviously I put in every year for all the draws. And I really, really, since I got that bighorn sheep, really wanted the elk tag. A Thule elk, I've just been obsessed by it. And so several years ago, a friend of mine told me about the share hunts you could put in for a pig. And so I started doing it. And then all of a sudden these elk hunts came available. And I've been putting in for, all the share elk hunts I can. So the share program, you're allowed to, I think there might be 20 of them now for elk. So you're allowed to pay, I think it's $12 or something. There's cow tags available, bull tags. And so each ranch, you're allowed to apply for each ranch. So I think I applied for probably 20 hunts. And I've been doing it since they started this program. And I wake up one morning, I get an email that says your share hunt results are available. And I'm scrolling through, and guys that apply for tags understand this. I'm, just like when you put in for all the X zones, and I'm scrolling through, it says unsuccessful. The whole screen's unsuccessful. I scroll up, unsuccessful. And so in my mind already, it's like, well, I didn't draw again. And I scroll up and the bottom one's green, successful. And I was shocked.
And that's that bull elk tag.
And that was a bull elk tag. And so, amazing, guys will kill me for letting the cat out of the bag, because there's a lot of people like me that have been putting in for these share hunts, and it wasn't too well known until the last few years. And now the word's got out, because it's an incredible opportunity that Fish and Game gives the hunting community to be able to have a chance to go have access to private property and get a tag that's a once in a lifetime. I mean, this is a once in a lifetime tag, really. It's the odds of getting this tag is very difficult. So it's a really good program. And I really want to thank, I've talked to people at the SHARE program with the DFG, and they're passionate about this program and they do a great job with it. So it's a good thing.
So when you get this shared elk tag, do you get contacted by the landowner? Do you contact the landowner yourself? How does that whole process work after?
They link you up. They link you. So it happened fast. So I literally, results came out something like the end of July. My hunt was 2 weeks from the time, maybe 3 weeks from the time I knew that I drew the tag. So they link you up, you get the landowner's contact info, you contact the landowner, then you make arrangements, and there's stipulations, things you can and can't do. It's all in there. I contacted the landowner, and it was the landowner's son-in-law who's in charge of the ranching on the ranch, and really accommodating, and just the whole experience from getting the tag to getting the information to talking with the landowner up to the hunt was incredible, because excitement built. After I'd spoke with him once or twice, he realized how passionate I was about it, and that I was a hunter and not just a person wanting to go, you know, that had no hunting experience, because that does happen sometimes. And he started sending me information and talking about the elk on his property, and they're really into the program as well.
Yeah, because them, you know, running the property as a ranch, I'm sure they're seeing the elk quite often, and so they have, like, you know, maybe a pattern that they've been in, or they know kind of the zones that they've been in on the ranch. How large was the ranch you were actually hunting?
So I was on 2,500 acres. And so what happens is, and this is why this program is becoming successful for both sides, the elk herd is growing all through California. The elk are doing very, very well. And so in this particular area, the herd's really growing, and they're nomadic. They just don't live in someone's field and not leave the field. They move around. And so they break fence lines. They eat a ton of their feed. This ranch was 2,500 acres, and they had, at the time I was there, about 120 head of elk on their property.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to imagine, you've got a property, you're a cattleman, and you've got 120 elk eating your feed source every single night. and then, you know, breaking fences and water lines, and it's like a love-hate relationship. You know, they love the animals, but at the same time, they're frustrated by it. So being able to manage a herd a little bit through the SHEAR program is a great opportunity for both sides.
It's a way to keep that population in check in those areas where they need to be. And then I'm sure that elk moves on and keeps moving through on other property. And it obviously, like you said, they're nomadic. They keep moving. So it was a really cool opportunity you had to get on there and have that little bit of inside information.
Yes.
Let's get right into the hunt. What happened? How did it all come about?
Well, I'll back up just a little bit for a second that kind of leads into the hunt. But so when I drew the tag, I called a great friend of mine, Matt Albertson, who is, in my opinion, one of the best. You know, there's hunters that love to hunt, and then there's hunters that are a hunter, like just, you know, just born with the instincts and the passion. And so I've been hunting with Matt for years and years, and he's just an incredible hunter, knows a lot about California and the different hunts. He's been on some really good hunts in California. So I called Matt, and he started doing research on the area. And I called my cousin, who lives in by Santa Rosa, who hunts a lot in that area. And my cousin got fired up and offered to let me use his fifth wheel. So then later on, he said, well, I offered to let you use my fifth wheel. So I'd go on the hunt with you. But he started doing some research, and Matt started doing research and trying to find out, you know, about the area. And luckily my cousin was able to get us hooked up with a rancher in that valley that let us use a walk-in cooler, which is a huge help in 100 degree weather. Matt had talked to some guys that had knew about the area and the size of the animals and what were kind of like what size bull was realistic for that area. And we were, you know, from what Matt was getting pictures and talking to people, and I was talking to Kyle, the rancher, and like Kyle's not really into like the score and he doesn't really understand that much part of it, you know. So Kyle's saying we've got a 7-point bull, and Matt's saying, well, a 260 class bull is probably realistic, which is a really, really good bull. Some areas have some really good genetics in California that have some really big elk, but it's just a small little area. So a 260 bull is a really good bull. So that in mind, we're thinking like you're going to kill a really good representation of the species, you know, and kill a really nice bull. May not be a record book bull, but you're going to kill a really good bull. And then we started hearing about, there was a 9-point. A few people had seen this 9-point bull across the valley, people had said. And so that was kind of the rumor about this big bull in the area. Kyle, the landowner, had never seen that bull. He had seen a couple really nice 7-point bulls, but he never seen a 9-point. And we got up there My cousin and Matt were with me. We met with Kyle. We went out and glassed on Thursday night. And we set up and we kind of started glassing from a distance. We didn't want to go into the area we were going to hunt. We wanted to stay back. So we stayed back about a mile and we started glassing canyons and watching them come out from their bedding area. And that night we saw some pretty good bulls. And I mean, they were bugling, they were fighting. We watched bulls fight. We saw a 6-point that was probably a 285 bull, which is a really good tule yoke, but it was a 6. I really wanted a bull that had the crown in the back, more of that tule elk characteristic.
Mm-hmm.
So got dark and we were excited and we're talking to Kyle and you know, the bulls that we saw, what is this the biggest bull you've seen? And he's like, well, there's one more 7-point that's a little heavier than the bulls we saw. And so that's kind of what we thought we were trying to target. And I was willing to be patient because I'm a patient hunter. It's not all about just a trophy, but I like the experience of the hunt. So we got up in the morning. We met Kyle at 5:30 in the morning down at the corner of the property on the other side of where we were at. And Kyle said, we're going to hike in about a mile and a half and we're going to get up into up on a ridge where we have a vantage point with some draws where I think we're going to have the best opportunity for elk coming through the draws that were surrounding us. So we get up, it's barely getting light. We set up and Kyle and my cousin Bill sat up on a knob, kind of glass in one direction, and Matt and I peeled off about 50 yards and sat down below them. It's dark. I mean, it's barely getting light, and you can already hear the bull screaming. I mean, because it's the rut's starting to really go, and you can hear them bugling. And so we see a pretty good bull go below us. There's a bull that we named the Broken Horn Bull. We'd seen him the night before, and he was a pretty good bull, but he had already broke a couple of tines off from fighting. And we saw him coming up. We saw a really nice 7-point, and Matt's on his spotting scope, and I'm on my binoculars, 15 by 50 Swarovskis. And Matt's, that's a nice bull, because I don't think that's what we're, you know, I don't think that's what we're looking for. He has more experience seeing tule elk than I do, so that's why I really want to melt Matt with me. And so we're watching, and we've had a few bulls come through and some cows, and all of a sudden we hear this scream, this really gnarly growl way down below. And we're looking at each other, and Matt's like, that's got to be a big mature bull. Matt starts cow calling. He's cow calling, and we got this, the 6-point we saw the night before came through, tempting because it's a really good tule elk, but it was a 6x6, and I really wanted, you know, multi-point, more characters of the tule. And so we've got this big bull below us with just a few cows. The cows keep looking down the hill, and this growling keeps going on. And all of a sudden, we see this bull down off the draw through the oak trees, and we could see he was big. And so he starts coming up the draw, and Matt's on the spotting scope. And I'm pretty calm, you know, and in my mind, I'm not really ready to pull the trigger, right? I'm not amped up or anything. So it's coming up this draw, and Matt's on the spotting scope, and he's counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Then he counts the other side, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And Matt looks at me and he goes, you know, I'd kill it because that's the one you want. Then it just like the switch flipped, and I'm pretty experienced. I've been on, you know, I've hunted a long time, you know, I've killed some really good animals, and I've learned, you know, the buck fever thing, right? So I'm standing up and next to an oak tree with a limb that's like 5 feet off the ground. I mean, everything's perfect. I got my gun over the limb and I'm shaking. I'm nervous. And this bull, so the bull comes up to the other bull, puts his head down and starts raking the dirt and throwing dirt. He's 10 feet from this bull, throwing dirt on this other big bull. And he's backing up and he's screaming at it and throwing dirt on him. And he wanted to take those cows with him. And I think those cows wanted to go with him. And Matt's like, you know, take him. And I'm like, I'm not on him good. You know, he's moving. And I just didn't want to, you know, blow the opportunity. And so they end up going over this ridge and had to take a deep breath. And so we just, I left my backpack and my binoculars on the ground because I was so kind of fired up, and I had my gun in my hand, and we just worked our way over the hill and we crawled up to a rock outcropping, and I got set up and laid down, and because I knew they're going to come out below us. We already saw the animals that were with him kind of in front of him. I got in position. I could see him through an oak tree, but I didn't want to take the shot through the tree. I just didn't want to blow such an opportunity. So it stepped out about 200 yards and was getting ready to go over, and he finally just kind of turned, and I shot and hit him really good, and he stepped forward a few times and kind of backed up, and you know, elk, you can't take a chance with an elk. So I shot again, and both my shots were, and I'm not the best marksman, I mean, I'm a good hunter, but both my shots were within an inch of each other.
Wow.
And he went about 50 feet and balled up in the canyon below. So at that point we knew he was big. Like Matt didn't want to say, he said, he's big. You know, it's not about the score. I mean, the score is awesome because the score means there's a lot of horn there, right?
And how do they count the score for people who don't know?
Okay. Well, so like, you know, Boone and Crockett measuring, you know, they have all these measurements. You take the inside width, you take the base, you take the typical points, you add everything up, and you got to deduct the non-typical points. So, you know, you want those longer tines, you want the mass. This bull wasn't lacking anything. I mean, it wasn't lacking anything. And I'm not really great at scoring because that's not, you know, I'm a trophy hunter in a sense that I want to put the effort in to kill the best animal I can kill. I want to kill a really good animal, but I'm not, you know, the kind of guy that's just trying to go get a trophy to put on the wall. Matt knew how big it was. I knew it was big, but I didn't, cause he was in the spotting scope. I was just focusing on the shot. So we walked back up to my cousin and Kyle, and we kind of sat there because we knew it was, yeah, we just kind of enjoyed the moment for a second. We just kind of sat there and we waited, you know, just to make sure we didn't go push a wounded animal. So we waited and then we started working our way down there, and we got up to above it, and Kyle saw it, and I handed my, Matt said, hand me your phone. He goes, I'm going to record you walking down there. When I walk down, guys that are hunters understand, you know, ground shrinkage, right? You shoot this animal because you're excited and think he's big, and then you get closer and it's not as big as you think. This thing kept getting bigger. So I walk up to it, and I was just, I mean, I honestly shed a tear. I mean, just from the, you know, excitement, it was like, it was amazing. So he actually ended up being scoreable points. He's a 10 by 8. So he had, like a deer would have, he had 2 points on top of his brow tines that are about an inch and a half long that are score, that are, you could count as a point. So he's a 10 by 8 bull.
Yeah. I'm looking at the photo right now as we're mm-hmm. talking, and I'm seeing those 2 inch and a half tines right above.
Mm-hmm.
That's, yeah. Jeez. Big animal.
The animal, the body, I mean, I'm an average Thule bull elk weight wise is like supposedly, you know, 500 pounds. He was every bit of 800 plus. Like he wasn't under 800 pounds, his body. He was huge. He was huge. The body was massive. And Kyle had never seen that bull before. You know, so these elk just don't live on a property and never leave. Like it, maybe he had seen it, not known, but he had never verified he'd saw that bull before. The biggest bull they've ever seen. And I believe, you know, who knows, people talk, rumors, whatever, but supposedly it's the biggest bull ever killed out of that valley, supposedly.
That's an amazing hunt. It's awesome how you got to go do it.
Yes.
And then for it to be successful, because we all know that not every hunt is successful. And for you guys to get out there, you guys did your research, obviously. You had the help you needed. It all came together.
Mm-hmm.
And being prepared like you guys were, it worked out.
Yeah, it was amazing. So the bull ended up scoring just under 303. It's like 302 and 5/8 or something.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, the points, 10 by 8, it's just, I was hoping to go kill a 7-point bull. That was my goal, to kill, kill a seven by seven. I was hoping, but honestly, at the end of the day, me and Matt talked about it. It's a tule elk. It's, whatever happens, and you got a tule elk. So, obviously we went prepared to try to put the effort into to find the biggest bull that we could find. And if we had to call it in to us and pull it in from somewhere, fortunately God was on my side that day. And it, for some reason, that bull just happened to be in the area, and we got lucky. To me, there's as much luck or more in hunting than there is. The skill comes in when you have to go take advantage of the opportunity, but the animal showing up a lot of times is luck.
Yeah, and the skill comes in when luck's on your side. Yes. You need to have the skill to be able to capitalize, and it sounds like you guys were just on point. It worked out.
Worked out great. And it was, like everything, you get excited for something, and you, for a year, you're dreaming about it, and you're so fired up, and then it happens, and it kind of wasn't as great as what you expected. This hunt from start to finish was flawless. I mean, the getting the tag to the drive up there to meeting with my cousin, who I don't get to see that. It's my, Bill's married to I call him my cousin, but he married my cousin. But getting to be able to hunt with him, because they're dairy farmers and they live 6.5 hours away. So my whole life, we always talk about hunting, but we never really had the opportunity to go on a hunt like that together. So those memories, Matt and I started going hunting together in the mid 90s. I started going to the Kaibab with Matt in 96. We'd drive into St. George, Utah, buy our tag over the counter, then go camp up in the Kaibab and bow hunt for deer. Matt and I would go from there, Colorado. One year we went from there to Colorado. After hunting for a week, we drove to Colorado, backpacked and hunted elk for a week. This is before I was married. But so then Matt moved up north. Works for the USDA. So same thing. We talk about hunting all the time. We don't get to hunt very often together. So, this is like one of those trips that'll be burned in my memory bank for forever. I mean, and then this monster bull just like, it caps it off, right? It's the whole deal, right down to my tournament partner, Fred, that I fish with, being able to get involved and help me with the story. And, Fred and I have been great friends for a long time. We hunt and fish together, and being able to have Fred do this for me means a lot, because he's passionate about what he does. And so all that the hunting community, it's the camaraderie, and it goes deeper than people know unless you're involved in it.
The hunting, the outdoor life, the fishing community, we all have this, definitely this camaraderie between us, where we all kind of respect each other. Yeah. And it really shows. And, mm-hmm. It worked out for you guys. I'm excited I got to talk to you today. And what's the next hunt you guys got planned?
I'm going, I'm pretty fortunate this year. I go to Wyoming every year. I didn't go last year, mm-hmm. but I go pretty much every year. I have friends from Hawaii that I go with. And Kurt, the gentleman I mentioned, we've been doing this for 20 years. And so I didn't draw an elk tag in 2019, but I drew an elk tag this year. So I'm going to Wyoming in October, and I drew an elk tag, a buck tag, and an antelope buck tag. So this might be a great year. And I also actually am heading up tomorrow back to Santa Rosa to pick my elk meat up. I had a butcher up in Santa Rosa cut it for me. So I'm going deer hunting Thursday morning with my cousin in Santa Rosa. So this is like, I got to wake up from this dream sooner or later, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I get to go on his cousin's property. They have a big property, and they have so much property to hunt that they only hunt one piece a year. They don't put too much pressure on it. So down here in A-Zone, I hunt public land. I'm pretty much a public land hunter. And so, this year's given me a lot more opportunity. Good season this year.
Well, I think that'll about wrap it up. It was good talking to you. Hopefully your next few hunts are just as successful. And we'll be hearing back from you pretty soon.
I really appreciate the publication and you taking your time, Daniel, for doing this podcast.
Yeah, no problem. And I'm stoked we were able to get together. All right, folks, and that's going to wrap it up for the Western Outdoor News Podcast. This was episode 33. For more information on trips, charters, and events held by Western Outdoor News, visit wonews.com.